So we're going to start with our second of our distinguished lecturers, and it's a real pleasure to have Bob Carver from Princeton University here with us this afternoon. Bob's actually a chemist, but he was telling me that he actually likes hanging out with physicists. In fact, so much so that he built a tunnel from his chemistry department directly into the physics department so he could hang out a bit more easily with the physics people there.
That was a good idea.
But we're very happy to have him this afternoon. So a bit of his background. Bob got his PhD from MIT in 78, and then he worked at Bell Labs for a period of time before then becoming a professor in chemistry at Princeton University. He's had a prolific scientific career with more than 500 publications, with approximately 40 of those appearing in either Science or Nature. And just in case you didn't think anybody was reading those publications, he's got over 30,000 citations to that work. So that's really pretty impressive. And I think is a good reason to why we should seriously listen to what he has to say this afternoon. So thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you very much. Well, it's great to be here. I'm a solid-state chemist, so this is a bit of a... what I do in life is to try do two things. I listen to what physicists are thinking about and then try and help by finding material that does something interesting from the perspective of physics. And then sometimes we come up with materials and I try to sell them to physicists, so there's a little bit of a sales job going on here, too. There are going to be parts of this that you find boring and parts that you find interesting. You have my permission to nap. There are three topics we'll talk about. The first one is superconductivity, and maybe this is a little odd, but I'm going to show you how we are going about looking for superconductors nowadays. Secondly, geometrically frustrated magnets, and I know there's a lot of activity in this community with frustrated magnetism. And then finally, Dirac semi-metals and topological insulators. We have a nice group at Princeton that works together nicely, and we have nice collaborations at Brookhaven as well. So starting point is searching for new superconductors using chemistry. So of course, superconductivity is the realm of physicists, but we've been wondering about whether there are other ways to look for them. And here is the first project of a postdoc, Weiwei Zhi. There you can see her there. So if we start with the classic intermetallic superconductor, niobium-310, you can think of it as a chains of niobium in a tin body center cubic tin lattice. But the point is that it superconducts due to happy electrons in K-space. So it's a real physics kind of superconductor. But then things start to get a little bit chemical, I think, when lanthanum barium cuprate and yttrium barium cuprate came along, and people started worrying about charge transfer. Once you start talking about transferring charge from one element to another, or one structural constituent to another, you're talking about chemistry. So in the language of this talk, the high TC cuprates are made of donor and acceptor structural fragments. So the CuO2 plane donates charge, donates electrons to the intermediary layer. So that's the donor, and the intermediary layer is the acceptor, and you end up with fewer electrons in the CuO2 plane than it came with. So this idea of charge transfer and structural fragments was very useful back in the cuprate days when we were trying to find a lot of new cuprate superconductors. And in compounds like niobium-310, we don't think of this as being a charge of involving charge transfer in a chemical sense. You think of a three-dimensional lattice with electrons in K-space, and you have an electronic structure, but you're not thinking in terms of charge transfer from one thing to another. Whereas in the cuprates, you have all those things in K-space, but the elements have different electronegativity, so there's definitely charge transfer going on. So my question that I raised with Weiwei is that maybe this is a blind spot in intermetallic superconductor research. We all know that different metals in the periodic table have different electronegativities, and therefore there has to be charge transfer between metals in intermetallic compounds, just like there's charge transfer in more ionic compounds like the cuprate superconductor. So what was our idea? Our idea was to look for an intermetallic structural fragment that supports superconductivity, and then take that structural fragment and make it a layer and put it in between some other metallic fragment and get charge transfer from one layer to another. Just like we did with the cuprates, we wanted to do it in an intermetallic compound. But we know the rules, and the rules are that certain structural motifs give rise to superconductivity while other ones don't. So you have to start with a layer that has a tendency towards superconductivity. And the one we converged on is rhenium 3 boron. It looks like this. It has this beautiful network of three rheniums around a boron. It's a 4 Kelvin superconductor. If you move over one column in the periodic table, you get the ruthenium 3 boron. That has 3 electrons fewer than rhenium 3 boron, so it's not likely to superconduct. On the other hand, if you put it in a layered compound where you put a niobium boride layer in between, this one has extra electrons, so it's going to donate the electrons to this layer here. We postulated, okay? Now look at that. If you look at, and the formula of that ends up being NbRuB. Now would you guess that there's charge transfer between niobium and ruthenium and boron in that structure type? No, you wouldn't guess it unless you started thinking of it in terms of a fragment kind of formalism. So it's a chemical formalism and ways to look at it. We thought that the ruthenium 3 boron fragment would get 3 electrons from the niobium 3 boron fragment and make a superconductor. Well, it did superconduct, luckily. 3.5 Kelvin, not that much worse than rhenium 3 boron. And you could do all kinds of chemical-based calculations where you can count the charge that was actually transferred. So in our simple picture, we thought that one would accept 3 electrons from the other one, but you can actually calculate that chemically. And we did find that indeed charge was transferred, but it was 1 electron, not 3. So the fact that these are all metals now and not ionic constituents means that they're sharing charge more than we thought and transferring charge less than we thought, but still there's charge transfer and still it ended up being a superconductor. Okay, next. So this charge fragment idea seemed to work in this case. And the idea is we're going to use this for the next couple of years, as long as Weiwei can stand being in Princeton, and try and find more. Go. Okay, next one. So there's good news and bad news about being an old person. And the good news is you can remember things that young people forgot or weren't alive for. And I do remember the layered dicalcogenides, which were a hot topic back in the 70s when I first started working at Bell Labs. And I've been able to find some interesting things in layered chalcogenides that others forgot to see in the 1970s. And one of the questions I have been wondering about is just how much the third dimension matters in these layered dicalcogenides. So you know they're beautifully layered structures. We'll look at them in a second. And I was asking just how much difference does it make, the stacking in the third dimension, when you take these layers and stack them up. And to understand the next topic, you're going to have to understand about polymorphs and polytypes. A polymorph is a variant of a structure that has the same formula as a compound, but in a different structural form. And a polytype is just what you get when you stack layers up in a different order. So for instance, an ABC stacking and ABABAB stacking are polytypes of a particular structure. So I managed to convince this ambitious postdoc there to do it. Oh yeah, but if you work on dicalcogenides, you have to worry about the troglodyte's revenge. And I'd like to thank John Greeden, where are you? For this, the first time I heard the word troglodyte referred to in context of referees. And these are the people who referee our manuscripts. I'm sure they look like that. And I don't see what good it does to be pessimistic, but they typically are. And so we're going to look at some of these layered dicalcogenides, and how can there possibly be something interesting to do in these after all these years? Well, we began looking at TiSe2, and TiSe2 is one of the world's most interesting compounds for a reason I didn't understand at first. If you count the charge on TiSe2, it looks like a normal valence compound. Titanium plus 4, no d electrons, selenium minus 2, all the p states filled. It should just be a semiconductor. But there's a bizarre thing that happens, which is that the valence band and conduction band literally touch at the Fermi energy, and it has a charge density wave transition that just untouches those bands. So unlike a typical charge density wave where you have nested Fermi surfaces and things like this, this charge density wave untouches bands that have different symmetries, and it could be an excitonic insulator or something. Anyway, it superconducts when you dope it with copper. That's our first thing that we found. Here's the phase diagram of copper doped TiSe2. The CDW is suppressed. Superconductivity appears. Here's TaS2. Notice this one has octahedra. So these are titanium selenium octahedra. These are tantalum sulfide triangular prisms. These are polymorphs. Okay. If it was the same metal inside there, the shape of the coronation polyhedron is different. Okay, that becomes superconducting too. So here's what we did. What about polymorphs and polytypes? If electronic systems are really two-dimensional, should the third dimension matter? Should the stacking dimension matter? And we found that the tantalum selenide telluride system is an excellent place to test the hypothesis about whether the third dimension matters in layered superconductors. And the result was kind of entertaining. So here's 2HTaSe2. It's a stable form of tantalum diselenide. It's got two layers, and the layers are triangular prisms. 3RTaSe2 is impossible to make in pure TaSe2, but you can make it if you put a little tellurium on the selenium site. Now it's got three layers. You put a little more tellurium in, and now you get a single layer octahedron. And if you put even more in, you get a triple layer octahedron. So what does the superconductivity do? Well, I probably don't have time to do all the details here, but you know, when you have layered compounds, you characterize the C over A ratio. It tells you how anisotropic something is. So that's something you can do here. You can see the layers start to come apart as you put tellurium in for selenium. That's the C-axis thing here. We plotted all the polymorphs and polytypes on the same curve. There's a place where you get mixed phase, but you see there's the in-plane dimension has a discontinuity, the out-of-plane dimension has a discontinuity, everything is a little bit discontinuous. We have the different forms there, blah, blah, blah. You can take it apart. For the solid-state chemist in the audience, this was my big shock. You put more tellurium in place of selenium, and the van der Waals gap shrank. What? So, you know, tellurium's big, highly polarizable. You would think the van der Waals gap would grow, but it didn't. Okay. That's for John, etc. Now let's look at the charge density waves. Okay, so we're competing charge density waves and superconductivity. The CDWs are two-dimensional, and the same CDW happens in every single one of these polymorphs and polytypes. So the CDW is determined by the 2D lattice of these MX2 layers. And you see them beautifully in electron diffraction. This is an example of low temperature electron diffraction, this one in the 3R polytype. You can see the beautiful CDW reflections that show up at 10 Kelvin, and you can watch them grow in with temperature. It's just a very, very powerful technique. But the same 2D charge density wave there is there in every one. Well, maybe that's deceiving because it's an average. Well, we live next door. The tunnel goes right to the physicists who have the STM, so we can look at the charge density wave in real space. Look how beautiful it is. There it is. These little images here, these are like the tellurium doping in the layer. You can see how they're randomly arranged, but you see these beautiful regions of the CDW. Here's the one with more tellurium doping, and that kind of scrambles the image, but the CDW is still there, and you can still see it. Okay, now it's superconducting. Never mind. Here's the phase diagram. So look at the superconducting transition temperature as you change the tellurium to selenium ratio in this thing. We have the 2H polymorph, which has the triangular prism. The 3R polytype, where we take that thing and we stack three of them instead of two. It kind of looks continuous. Then when we go to the other one, that's the one in an octahedron, TC suddenly drops. So certainly the polymorph matters. When you go from here to here, superconductivity went down, even though the charge density wave is the same. Okay, and here's a plot that I really like. This is the superconducting transition temperature versus two ways to characterize the layered compounds. The first way is the standard way, which is C over A. It measures the distortion, the ratio of the thickness of a layer to its size in plane. And there's TC versus X versus this parameter. There's no continuity. So the 3R has a TC versus a composition that looks like this. The 2H is over here. It's not on that line. The 1T is over here, over there. Nothing to do with it. Well, I can take it apart further and just look at the structural characteristics of only the MX2 layer, not counting the van der Waals gap, and it's still different. There's no continuity anywhere. So the stacking and the polymorph finally matter. All right, that's just a little part of the story. Next, this one is more relevant to things that you guys work on around here. This is geometric magnetic frustration in rare earth pyrochlore. So Michel Gingras, who is one of your colleagues, emails me every once in a while, and 5 years ago he started emailing me about the symmetry of rare earth pyrochlores, and I'm sure it was because he saw Bruce's single crystal neutron diffraction data that showed the OO2 reflection in a single crystal of these rare earth pyrochlores. So Michel kept emailing me about it, and I couldn't think of an experiment to do. And then one day I sat across from Bruce at some kind of panel meeting or something, and he showed me this data. I said, "Yeah, look, the OO2 reflection is really there. This reflection, which is from his single crystal neutron diffraction data in three of these different rare earth pyrochlores, is really there. But it violates the space group symmetry of pyrochlores, which is FD3M. And in these silly rare earth pyrochlores, where the interactions are only 1 Kelvin or whatever, I mean, it's insanity. Everything counts, right? Disorder counts. Symmetry certainly counts. Everything counts. So if the symmetry is wrong for these pyrochlores, it makes a big difference. So, but the question was how to tell whether that reflection is there by accident or on purpose. So the idea that finally dawned on me is that we should do a synchrotron powder X-ray diffraction experiment. There's my student, Kristen. What does the synchrotron have that's different? It has no lambda over 2 contamination. First of all, the neutron beam can be contaminated with lambda over 2. There's no residual magnetic field, so if that had something to do with magnetism, it couldn't be there. No magnetic scattering, no multiple scattering. So this is a pure structural probe that does not, it's a less complex measurement, so it would allow us to tell whether the structural symmetry is really FD3M or not. And the other thing that the synchrotron has, and the people who work the synchrotron in Argonne are very, very nice and cooperative people. We told them what experiment we wanted to do. They helped us design it to be optimal. Notice the number of counts in the main peak, 300,000 counts. So there's a huge dynamic range in a synchrotron diffraction experiment, and the resolution is absurd. So now we're going to look at the details of these rare earth pyrochlores that Kristen made to test this hypothesis about whether the OO2 reflection is present or not. So we took diffraction patterns for ytterbium, erbium, and holmium titanate, made in very, very large batches so that she could get the stoichiometry right, made them as powder so they were never melted. Melting is an important issue in the preparation of materials because if something melts, it may not refreeze to the same composition. And when you grow things in an FZ furnace, for example, they may not refreeze to the same composition you started with. So we made powders. And then we looked at a sensitivity level of about 1 part in 30,000, and there was no sign of an OO2 peak in anything. And that includes materials that were stoichiometric for ytterbium, erbium, and holmium, and materials that we intentionally made non-stoichiometric to test the effect of stuffing. So stuffing is when you put a small amount of rare earth on the B side in the pyrochlore, which is possible. And so that 2OO reflection, the OO2 reflection, whoops, never showed up. So there is no, to 1 part in 30,000, there is no violation of FD3 bar M. And I know that you're all troglodytes, closet troglodytes, and that even though there was no indication of a structural phase transition or any kind of phase transition in holmium and any of these things down to low temperatures, I knew you'd want to see the low temperature pattern. That was a lot harder to get, but at 10 Kelvin, we can't go to 0.01 Kelvin, but at 10 Kelvin, we still don't see a peak in one part in 30,000. Well, while we were at it, we noticed a couple of interesting things, and that is that the synchrotron has such high resolution that you can observe the stuffing, the small amounts of stuffing, meaning the small changes in unit cell size that go along with a fraction of a percent of stuffing, are actually visible in the synchrotron diffraction pattern by a change of a unit cell dimension. So here's one of a representative peak that shifts dramatically in angle as you go from pure holmium titanate, which is this one over here, to stuffed holmium titanate over here. And then look, here's a peak from a floating zone crystal of nominally stoichiometric holmium titanate. You'll notice two things about it. One, it's not falling at the same position that stoichiometric holmium titanate falls at. The second thing you notice is that the peak width is broader than for the perfect polycrystalline sample. So this is just one thing is shown here. This is the change in unit cell parameter for the stuffed ytterbium titanate and the stuffed holmium titanate. It's a very sensitive measure. This is whatever it is, 5 parts in 10,000 change in unit cell here. It's a way of monitoring the stuffing. And then now we're going to look at the peak widths. There are two ways you can get peak widths. You can imagine that the stuffing is going to break up the crystallites so that the coherent region of scattering gets smaller and smaller as you put in some kind of disorder. That's one thing. The other thing that can happen is that the stuffed rare earth introduces strain. It introduces a variation in unit cell size in its local vicinity. And that variation in unit cell size at a local scale can give rise to a peak broadening just the same way that particle size broadening can give a rise to wider peaks. But the sine theta dependence of the two things is different. So the theory says that the full width at half max of these peaks should be a straight line on a 4 sine theta plot. And you could see in the stuffed holmium titanate, you get this beautiful linear relationship with a fixed slope that's related to the strain. And pure holmium titanate, no strain. So this is strain broadening due to the presence of the distortion of the lattice locally around a holmium that's going into a site that's too small for it. And the other thing you can do is look at this FZ crystal, which in a normal diffraction experiment will look fabulous. But in the stupid synchrotron from which you can hide nothing, shows a peak that is actually double. So this FC crystal of holmium titanate, probably everybody's FC crystal, is a slightly inhomogeneous mixture of two phases. All right. Next frustrated magnet project. So I told you, you already heard that I like hanging out with physicists and I like hearing what's on your mind. So in two places in a year, theoretical physicist said to me, Bob, you need to make a pyrochlore that has stronger interaction strengths, not 1 Kelvin, so that we can study the properties at higher temperature. So I need a pyrochlore lattice that has stronger interactions between spins in it. And, well, the rare earth pyrochlore is just the magnetic interactions are extremely weak. But it eventually dawned on us that we could make pyrochlores out of fluorine instead of oxygen, and then if we put fluorine in instead of oxygen, we could balance the charge by putting transition metals in the pyrochlore. So let me show you what's going on here. Here's your normal rare earth pyrochlore. Here's the tetrahedron from the rare earths, okay? So that's where in the rare earth pyrochlores, that's where you have your magnetic atom. But the other lattice, which is the B-site lattice, which is normally titanium, is also a tetrahedra, 1, 2, 3, 4. It's actually an identical lattice of corner-sharing tetrahedra to the rare earth lattice. So it's identical. So if we could put a magnetic atom in there and have the A site non-magnetic, we can make a new class of frustrated magnets. And we can put transition elements in that site, which is good because transition elements, 3D transition elements in particular, have stronger magnetic interactions. So this might work. So let's see. So we're going to start with Dy2Ti207. It's a nice ionic compound. The charges all add up. It's an insulator. If we go to the point where we want to put divalent atoms on here, which is what we have to do in the 3D series to get nice magnetic materials, like cobalt and nickel and even iron, divalent iron on the pyrochlore lattice, or cobalt and nickel and manganese, these could all work. Now we're going to put fluorine here. And now, unfortunately, or fortunately, fluorine has a charge of -1. So you have an odd number of charges here. So to balance the charge here, you need an odd number of charges on the A site. So to do that, you have to mix two non-magnetic atoms on the A site. So it would be A prime, A double prime, B2, F7. And these two things are going to disorder on this lattice here. Let's see what happens. Okay, there's a reason why no one works on fluorides, and the reason is that you get garbage when you buy fluorides from the source, and you have to purify them. And how do you purify fluorides? You heat them in gaseous HF. Now, if you go into your lab and tell your students, even if they're chemistry students, that you're going to purify samples by heating them in HF, they're going to have a fit, because nobody wants a tank of HF in their lab. And this kid whose project this was his defining moment as a graduate student, because instead of crying when his co-workers said, no way are you doing something with HF, he built an in-situ HF generator. So here's a furnace. Here's a special fluorine-resistant nickel alloy furnace that is wrapped with the heating elements. And inside here, he has a fluoride that decomposes. It's KHF2 or some crazy thing. It decomposes at high temperature to release HF. The HF in situ attacks whatever you put in there to create a fluoride. And then the exit gas is all scrubbed with these scrubbers, and nothing gets out in the lab. But this was quite an elaborate thing. This whole job goes inside the dry box because these are water sensitive. So he used a floating zone furnace after that to grow three of these fluorides. And he says they look just like Jolly Ranchers. There they are. So sodium, calcium, cobalt fluoride, sodium, strontium, cobalt fluorine, and sodium, calcium, nickel fluoride grow beautiful crystals in the floating zone furnace after you've gone through a lot of work to fix them. And here is the Curie-Weiss law. And this was very gratifying to me because look at those straight lines in the 1 over chi plot. They are awesome. And look at the thetas. The Curie-Weiss thetas are 140, not 1, like you have in the rare earths, but 100. So there are 100 times stronger interactions. And you could see that they show the classic behavior for a frustrated magnet, straight line with a big negative intercept and no magnetic ordering anywhere near theta. And what happens? I'll show you what happens down here. But they're highly frustrated. Something happens in 2 to 3 Kelvin. And the transition at 2 to 3 Kelvin are all glassy. So keep in mind that the sodium and calcium are disordered on that A site. And that's an off-site disorder. They're not directly bonded to the cobalt. The cobalts are bonded to the fluorines. But these other A sites are also then bonded to the fluorines on the other side. So they introduce some kind of weak disorder, but the disorder that they introduce seems to be enough to generate this spin glass state at 2 Kelvin. I'm convinced that if the disorder wasn't there, they would have just kept going, that they would have just cooled to much, much lower. But the disorder is causing the spin glass transition. So I think that this 2 Kelvin is a measure of the strength of the disorder in the system introduced by this off-site thing. And they follow a nice kind of spin glass behavior that you've seen before. All right, then you can start counting the entropy, and you can make the non-magnetic analog sodium calcium zinc fluoride and subtract its entropy from the entropy from the magnetic ones and start to sum the entropy up. And you can see now that they're summing to around R log 2, not R log 2s plus 1, which you would expect from the Heisenberg system. So there's something interesting going on there. These are very new, so work is in progress now. In fact, Kate Ross, a student of Bruce's, is doing some neutron scattering on them. Okay, I'm talking fast enough to get to the end. Keep going. Oh, sometimes we just make things for fun. If anybody here would like to look at cesium, copper, chloride, bromide, we have gigantic crystals of this thing. We made it because it's an analog to the cuprates, cuprate superconductors with copper and chlorine instead of copper and oxygen. And a high school student grew these crystals, and then when I tried to sell them to our local neutron scatterer, he didn't want them. So, yeah, whatever. All right, next. Topological insulators and Dirac semi-metals. I have a nice crew of people working on these. Most of them are graduated already, but there's lots of surprises here. The first thing I want to talk about is the search for the perfect topological insulator. Now, the word insulator The word insulator it's kind of a theoretical idea at first, and that is that you could have these conductive surface states, but that the bulk of the material had to be electronically insulating. And the point there being, if you want to measure the transport of these surface states, you don't want interference from the bulk states. And since the bulk is many times, thousands of times the volume of the surface, then it's a tricky matter to make a practical material that does this. And one of the fundamental characteristics of topological insulators is that they're small band gap semiconductors. Small band gap semiconductors to a chemist means small difference in electronegativity between the positive charges and the negative charges, which means small defect formation energy, which means very hard to make a perfect crystal with no defects. And the only way to get a bulk insulator is to have a minimal number of defects. So you need to find some kind of chemical system with minimal numbers of defects. So what are the primary requirements for finding the perfect topological insulator? First, very high bulk resistivity so that the transport of charge is dominated by surface states. Secondly, you would like the surface Dirac point to be isolated from the bulk valence band and the bulk conduction band. If you can manage to make a defect-free material and fill it with electrons so that the electrons are in the surface states, you don't want any interference from the bulk states. And in many of the topological insulators, the Dirac point is buried in the valence band. So that's not good. We want the mobility of the surface states to be high. And this is from a practical perspective. You want this thing to be reasonable to make. You want it to be possible for this to be made reproducibly. So we've been concentrating on the Bridgman growth method. This is a beautiful furnace. It's about the size of a person. And you can. It's a method that was used for decades for standard semiconductor research. And it works very nicely for these topological insulators. So we start working on this in 2008. Where we started with a resistivity of bulk resistivity of bismuth selenide of 0.1 milliohm centimeters. In bismuth telluride, you're able to put bismuth on the tellurium site and balance some problems to get to 10 milliohm centimeters. Bismuth tellurium selenide 6, tin dope bismuth tellurium selenide 20, and now we're up to 100 ohm centimeters on tin dope bismuth antimony tellurium sulfide. Now that looks like a lot of elements in that thing, but I'm going to show you that it's really a simple material. Now there are other people have tried other ways to try and get insulating material, but it's not so simple. Bismuth selenide is the conceptually simplest one, but it just doesn't work. Selenium wants to be in the gas phase, and you make selenium vacancies. You just cannot do it. So here's the state of the art in bismuth selenide as of 3 months ago. 100 milliohm centimeters right there, okay? That's down here somewhere. So that one's just too simple. Then there's some very nice results on bismuth, antimony, tellurium, selenide, thin films, but chemistry is not working in your favor there. As the materials maker, you have to control all those elements perfectly to get that to work. All right, until now, bismuth, tin, tellurium, selenide was the best one. I think I'll just skip this little story. Here's what we did recently. We put everything together and came up with this. The reason I like this so much, bismuth antimony tellurium sulfide, is that it's self-regulating. It self-selects a stable composition. A physicist would look at this and go, oh my God, five elements, I'm going to kill myself. But the point is that the formula selects itself. So You remember Linus Pauling, right? So there's the mineral called tetradymite, which is what all these are named after, and the mineral tetradymite is bismuth tellurium sulfide. And Linus Pauling said, the formula of bismuth tellurium sulfide can't be what you all think it is. It has to be something different because the sulfur is just too small to go in between the layers of the bismuth. There's going to be too much strain in this structure. Here's a layer of small atoms. Here's bismuth. Here's a layer of big fat atoms. This layer of atoms and this one can never match. It just can't work. He said it can't work because the sulfur layer is too small. Well, I can get that layer to be perfect sulfur layer if I decrease the size of this layer in between. So this one here can accommodate all the strain if I just make it smaller. How do I make this bismuth layer smaller? Put antimony in it. First thing. So it can select for the sulfur layer here. And this sulfur layer is strongly bonded to these metals. It's the most electronegative element, so it's going to want to go here where it can bond to more metals than it can up here. So that's not a complete explanation, but you get the idea. The chemistry conspires to put one sulfur in the middle and make a bismuth antimony mixture at a 1-to-1 ratio because it matches the sizes. Okay, 5 elements, but it has no choice. There's a single crystal of it grown by this floating zone method. That thing is that long. Okay, it's all the same thing. Not ordered. No, sir. Now what do you get? Now you get this crazy stuff. Now, over the whole boule, so crystal growers like to write A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K up the edge and then slice it up. Then you see what the properties are at different points on the boule. And they all show this kind of semiconducting behavior somewhere in the middle. It's really spectacular. And look at this. Here's strongly thermally activated. The activation energy is 160 millivolts, which is exactly half the band gap. So that is exactly an intrinsic semiconductor. And if it was really a normal semiconductor, it would just keep going. Well, what happened? It got interrupted by the surface states. So this part right here, this is the surface state conductivity dominating it's short-circuiting the bulk. And the carrier concentration is now dropping, and it's getting hung up at a minimum of 10 to the 14 because now that's the surface. The regular bulk is lower than that. And here's my favorite picture ever in topological insulators. It's our collaborators at Brookhaven who did the ARPES spectra. Well, here's the normal filling of this thing. Here's the surface state. Here's where it's filled. So here's the Dirac cone right here. Here's the crystal that they looked at. It's filled here. It's only in the surface states. You go down 100 millivolts, there's a Dirac point. So the Dirac point is a point in K-space. Nobody else home by itself. Okay, go down further, another 200 millivolts, then you hit the valence band. So in this end, what they can do is they can deposit potassium on the surface so they can fill the states that are normally empty. The potassium donates its charge. Now you can see the conduction band and you can see the rest of the surface states and you come up with a picture that looks like this. So not only is it a bulk insulator, the Dirac point is isolated by 200 millivolts and 120 millivolts on the other end. It's really good. So we think that this is the perfect, finally the ideal topological insulators. Self-controlled formula lets you grow big crystals. It's a real intrinsic bulk insulator. The Dirac point is isolated. We have high surface state mobility, which you can tell by seeing these quantum oscillations from the surface states, which are not there in 99% of all crystals that have been tested by other things. Okay, blah, blah, blah. We grow crystals. Sodium 3 bismuth is a Dirac semi-metal. People first were melting it just directly from the melt, but that's nasty. The best way to grow sodium 3 bismuth is to cool it from sodium metal flux. I don't think we'll have too much time to talk about this, but there's what happens to sodium. Leave it out in the air. Our ARPES guys, all our collaborators deserve a reward for working on this. Sodium 3 bismuth spontaneously ignites in air, and so all the all the physicists are in there in our glove box, you know, with those big black gloves that are like crazy, and they're in there putting their contacts on sodium 3-phosphate. They see beautiful Landau levels in the STM. Here they are. They can follow the Dirac dispersion in the STM beautifully. Blah, blah, blah. Next. Okay, now comes some sales. Sales pitch. We find a lot of materials, you're going to make a sign at me when we're getting too close, that are interesting, and I need physicists to think they're interesting too, although, you know, of course, you have the right to not think they're interesting. And one of them is ruthenium-2-tin-3. So just because you have main group elements that have inversion and give you a topological insulator doesn't mean there's no possibility to do this with a transition element. And transition elements are more interesting than main group elements, so they might do something interesting. So we looked around for transition element-based compounds that might be topological insulators. And we came up with ruthenium-2-tin-3. It has a chain of rutheniums and tins running along one direction. That's what's called a chimney ladder compound for the solid-state chemists in the audience. It's semiconducting with a formulae Ru2SN3. There's a calculated band structure. You can see that looks like a semi-metal. Just barely like a semi-metal calculated, but this band structures are not always exactly right, you know, but they're pretty close. And when you deconvolute the states, you can see that it's left ruthenium 4D states at the top of the valence band and tin states in the conduction band, so that's inverted. The band structure is inverted. And here is the ARPA spectrum of the Fermi surface. What the heck is that? So, you know, it's another case of you see it, and then a year later you figure out what the heck it is. And this was done by Sergei Borisenko. And the next slide should show it. So here are the energy cuts. So here's the Fermi. Here's what that the surface Fermi surface looked like. It was this star with a six-fold star. And then here are the energy cuts. You can see how the Dirac point, the surface Dirac point, is a function of position in the Brillouin zone. It's actually going up like that. And the final picture is here. So here's this highly anisotropic Dirac cone with a funny shape. In Ru2SN3, it's filled to there, but it's something crazy. So there is its equivalence to bismuth selenide. We don't know what this kind of thing is supposed to do, but basically, it's a point in one direction, and then it's elongated in another direction. Tungsten telluride. You can imagine why we start looking at tungsten telluride. Heavy elements, you know, tungsten, chemist knows tungsten has two electrons in d orbitals. They're going to form a pair in the x and the z squared direction. So tungsten telluride should be a semiconductor like MOS2, but it's heavier. Well, we put tungsten telluride in the machine and we saw it had a big magnetoresistance. So we decided to write a paper called Ludicrous Magnetoresistance in Tungsten Ditelluride with a reference to Spaceballs. Did you see Spaceballs? Ludicrous speed. Well, Ludicrous didn't make it, so we called it Titanic. So Titanic Magnetoresistance in Tungsten Telluride. So we submitted a paper that had the title Titanic Magnetoresistance in Tungsten Ditelluride, and we ran into a troglodyte. And a troglodyte said, it's not, you can't call it Titanic, you have to call it large. So the Titanic sank, and now we have large magnetoresistance. Tungsten telluride is really interesting. So I told you that, you know, in molybdenum disulfide, you have the dz squared orbital filled, which generates a semiconductor. But in tungsten ditelluride, in order to kill those two extra electrons, you actually make two bonds between tungstens. So I have to kill two electrons, so I'm going to stick them in a tungsten-tungsten bond. And so I'm going to make a linear chain of tungstens that eats that extra electron, those two extra electrons. There's the chain. And when I do that, I end up with a semiconductor again. But it's actually a semi-metal. The bands don't quite not touch with a really, really high resistivity ratio. And then when you put it in a magnetic field, the resistance goes up by a bajillion percent. Just goes way up. You can see in our first thing in the lab, up to 14 Tesla, you can see the low temperature resistance going up by four orders of magnitude in the field. First, I thought it might be a charge density wave or something like that, but there's no extra peaks in the diffraction pattern. And people don't know it, but electron microscopes have a 3 Tesla field where the sample is, so you can actually measure the structure in a field, and there's nothing there. And then here's the resistivity, but we want to go up to the next couple of plots. If you want to talk in percent, the MR is 13 million% at 60 Tesla, went up by a lot. And it goes up as H squared all the way. Here are the quantum oscillations. For you closet troglodytes out there, bismuth saturates. So bismuth goes up with T squared, but then it saturates somewhere. This one just keeps going up. We haven't found the limit yet. And it's a very delicate semi-metal. So just like I was explaining to you, it has holes and electrons. The pockets are different shapes, apparently. Somehow this electron hole balance gives you this very high magnetoresistance. That's what you people all know. But somehow it's magically balanced to give a perfect thing in tungsten ditelluride. This looks more to me like TiSe2 than anything else. So I personally think it's an exotonic large magnetoresistance, but what do I know? Still going. A few more minutes. Spin orbit coupling. I'm thinking, what has high spin orbit coupling? Gold. Okay, the color of gold comes from spin orbit coupling. What's some heavy thing we can make with gold? What's the heaviest thing I can think of? Well, I guess uranium, but maybe lead. And I like alchemy, okay? So I thought gold and lead, they might do something interesting. So we made gold to lead. You can see how I think. Gold to lead is reported a 1 Kelvin superconductor and it has a lot of spin orbit coupling. But first of all, we thought, is gold to lead really a 1 Kelvin superconductor? Yes, it is. So we characterized the superconductivity. It's really a 1 Kelvin superconductor. Then, when the students were measuring the resistivity as a function of temperature, they saw all these glitches in the resistivity. And typical of an advisor, which I guess is a good thing, I said, I don't believe it. Measure it again. So they kept measuring it and measuring and measuring, and up came these two glitches in the resistivity curve. You can see them right there. And let's see what those came from. Well, gold to lead has the cubic Lavis phase structure, one of the most common intermetallic structure types. And what is the cubic Lavis phase structure? It's a triangular lattice of lead in between a pyrochlore lattice of gold. Uh-oh, pyrochlore lattice showing up again. So here is the structure of gold to lead. At high temperature, it has a pyrochlore lattice of gold, colored gold, with lead in between. When you cool it off, it undergoes a structural phase transition where there's a structural distortion. And we found a very nice collaborator at the synchrotron, Saul Lapidus, who determined the structure at low temperature. So there's a phase transition. Those two little blips mean that it's undergone a phase transition. What was the surprise? The surprise was that the phase transition turned this material into a topological semi-metal. In other words, it has states at the Fermi energy. Let's look right over here. These are just calculated, though. It's a semi-metal, and we think that these states here give rise to the superconductivity, but over here, it's got an inverted band structure, so this thing at 1 Kelvin should be a superconductor with topological surface states. We don't know, but there it is. You're welcome to work on it. Next surprise, almost the last surprise, topological rat poison. So if you want to kill rats, you take calcium phosphide, which is amorphous, and you stick it in a hole somewhere, and it gets wet. And when it gets wet, it releases phosphine gas, which is nasty stuff that you don't want to breathe either. However, if you're one of my students and you haven't thought about that very much, and I tell you to try to make calcium phosphide, you might do it anyway, and it might smell bad, and you might open the tubes in the hood after the first time. Okay, that's good. We didn't kill the student. That was Lilia. And it turned out what we were making, which was unintentional at first, is we were making Ca5P3H. Now, I don't know if this community thinks much about H minus. But H minus is a hydride ion. It's because of LaO F-E-A-S-H, right? Because the guy in Japan, Hosono, used it as a negative ion. But we made this hydride, and then it decomposed and released hydrogen. Hydrogen leaks out of everything at 1300 degrees to make Ca3P2. Here's the crystal structure of Ca3P2. It's a beautiful honeycomb array of calcium and phosphorus. But now let's look at the calculated electronic structure of Ca3P2. When I students brought me this band structure, I said, "What? What is that?" So here's an inversion. Here's a band inversion in Ca3P2. Light elements, hexagonal structure, some kind of inversion. Maybe it looks like graphene. I had them actually calculate the 3D electronic structure. Here it is. Two cones that cross and make a Dirac ring. So Ca3P2 has a Dirac ring. What do Dirac rings do for a living? I don't know. Do you know what they do for a living? Please be interested. Okay, end of story. Here's what I tried to do. Chemistry is a well-developed formalism. So if you live in a chemistry department, they're always talking about charge transfer, bonding, blah, blah, blah. Good, they understand everything. So now we want to take all that understanding that where they don't care about the properties of matter and try and make it do something interesting from an electronic perspective, and we're using it to predict new superconductors. Sometimes it works. Like anything with superconductivity, sometimes it doesn't work. Layered dicalcogenides are still interesting. I think there's a lot to do with in there still. I think what's cool about geometric magnetic frustration is how the materials and theory and experiments are developing in parallel. Some fields, those things are out of sync. That one is really in sync. I think that's much to its power. Topological insulators give new physics, and so it's not obvious how chemistry can matter in that case, but in this case as well, things seem to be synergistic, and there's lots of new materials action. And finally, I'd like to say, if you ever have any idea for a new material or you're interested in any of these things, please come and talk to me. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob. We have time for questions.
Uridates, too, but I left out the uridates. Yeah. Whoops. I don't have the.
You talked about tungsten dipolide.
Yes. Yes. So, sadly, tungsten ditelluride superconducts under pressure, and we didn't find it. So that's the sad part. So that becomes superconducting under pressure. Were you talking about molybdenum diselenide? Or?
I was talking about tungsten diselenide.
Oh, yeah. So tungsten diselenide has a different crystal structure, and it's more like a conventional semiconductor where it has this dz squared orbital filled. But still, that's good. Yeah. I wish we had found the superconductivity, but we didn't.
Sorry. I wonder, so you talked about the glass transition that you have in the transition metal pyrochlore. So was that, it went by a little quick, but was that the same transition in the nickel system as well? So
now look at that. Yeah, they're almost the same. I have to point it down there, don't I? Oh. Yeah. It's interesting. The nickel one is shockingly similar.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, actually.
Yeah. How could it be that cobalt, so 3/2 cobalt, divalent cobalt, which should be like Ising or something like that.
Right. Well,
Heisenberg.
So you could easily expect different anisotropies.
So at this level, which is the generic characterization level, they are the same. Where are they?
The next one, I think. Yeah.
So the spin glass transitions look the same, around 3 Kelvin, 2 Kelvin. They're a little bit different, right? And then the susceptibility, the colors are beautiful.
Right. Yeah, I guess
if you plot these on a reduced plot, which I have somewhere, they all come out almost the same. It's just above. It's just down here where they start to get different. So the theta is up here, and they're all doing nothing at theta. But then when you get to a tenth of theta or something like that, then they start to look different. So. And I don't know what that comes from.
Yeah, thank you.
There was a theory that predicted a long time ago about this off-site disorder giving rise to glassy transitions and frustrated.
So in this polymorphs, I mean, you were talking about these different structures.
Thank you for being interested in that.
So is the understanding there that the charge density wave is somehow like very local electronic physics, and so it doesn't care about the details of this layering, but whereas the Fermi surface that gives rise to superconductivity, that is somehow more sensitive to the three-dimensional structure? Is that the...
Well, that's a good question. So if the CDW is 2D and the superconductivity is more 3D, that's...
Yeah, or somehow it's kind of local correlations that's driving the charge order and not the details of the Fermi pockets that are there in the...
Right. Yeah, well, anyway, I'm just wasting time, but... Yeah, that maybe that's a reasonable hypothesis. So that the now the ARPAS people, we have ARPAS data on the Fermi surface of the 3R, which is this one. It looks just like the Fermi surface of the 2H, and the TCs are different by a factor of 25. Okay, so 25 different. The Fermi surface looks the same. But maybe it's what's happening somewhere. Not the 2D, but somewhere else. I don't know. Yeah, it's got to be something, right? It can't be nothing.
So I have a question about the last material, calcium 3 phosphate.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So you showed the band structure calculation, right? Do you remember whether there were also electron or hole pocket or just a ring?
That's just it.
Just a ring?
I think that's all there is. Let's see. Getting there. Oh, I like that picture.
I
found a good trigonometry, didn't I?
Yeah. So what is being measured for this material other than structure?
Crystal structure is measured.
Yeah.
We're trying to grow crystals of it now.
Okay, we don't have crystals yet.
So we know the crystal structure, and we know the calculation.
Okay.
And those are all the states right there. Okay, so.
No, we have a sort of trivial but little calculation we recently did. If you apply a magnetic field in the direction parallel to the plane of the ring, then we discover that basically you have almost flat zero mode. So you should see a basically peak in the density of state.
Oh.
So that what actually happens is that if you apply a magnetic field along the plane parallel to the ring, then for each momentum along that direction, you know, if you make a cut, basically you always cut to Dirac point.
Mm-hmm.
And the distance, you can change the distance between two Dirac points when you cross the ring.
Okay.
And so you have a sort of coupled two Dirac cone problem. And
so,
so
it should be possible to do that experiment.
Yeah, so this is very simple,
yeah,
I think, experiment one can do that may tell us whether the ring is actually there or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So this is a calculation, so.
Right. Right,
yep.
not real.
Mm-hmm.
It's the whole structure.
It's a three-dimensional material, isn't it?
Supposedly all of it, although I don't know the designations of those points. It's the 2D. Yeah, where's the third dimension?
Yeah, this one is.
Whoops. That's a good question. What's the dispersion in the third direction? Thank you for noticing that. What's the other direction? Ask these guys why it's a ring. Two parabolas crossing, right. At that. Yeah. Just isotropic in the plane. Yeah.
Okay, thanks. I think we'll have to move on, but let's thank Bob again for an excellent talk.